This is the Porno Cultures Podcast, the show where we think about pornography rather than just react to it. To the first episode of the Porno Cultures Podcast. For those who don't know me, I'm a PhD candidate in Concordia University, which is in Montreal, and I'm currently working on a dissertation that focuses on the effect of resonance, of how pornography kind of shapes the way we think about the notions of confession, what happens when we see pornography on smartphone screens, television screens, and public spaces, and what that does to spaces. And also, I have one chapter in my dissertation about the YouTube celebrity Chris Crocker and how someone can go from a viral YouTube celebrity into kind of a transmedia porn celebrity, because he eventually wound up doing porn just a few years ago. So, yeah, that's kind of the work that I do, and I'll leave a link in the show notes to some of the articles that I've written so you can see where I come from when it comes to my academic perspective on pornography, kind of see what kind of work I'm about. I'm really excited about this first episode. The whole point of the podcast is to interview academics and influencers within the porn community who are shaping the way we think about porn within our wider culture. So while there's mostly an academic aspect to the podcast, there are going to be many other guests who are not academics, but are really doing really interesting and compelling work through blogging, through archiving, through performing, to help us think about pornography in new ways. This is a really special episode for me, not only because it was my first time doing an interview, so you can kind of see how I evolve, I guess, through this first interview. Hopefully, I don't sound too nervous, but I'm really excited about this podcast because we're interviewing Peter Alalunas. He's a professor at the University of Oregon in their Media Studies Department, and in this interview, I'm interviewing him about his first book, which is called Smutty Little Movies, The Creation and Regulation of Adult Video from 1976 to 1986. I talk about the first time that I meet him and how the first time I encountered his work 4 years ago, I was just stunned by the quality of it, the historical research, and really finding out stuff that we, within the discipline of porn studies, don't even know about. The remarkable part about this book is that he tracks the history of adult video from the early 1970s. It's very rare when you're reading a book and then in the middle of it you realize to yourself, wow, I'm actually in the process of reading a landmark text. This book, and not to be overly hyperbolic about it, but in all reality, this book is his now, in my opinion, one of the most fundamental books in the porn studies canon, simply because in its first part, it documents a history of adult video on videotape that a lot of people didn't know that, you know, there was amateur porn being recorded on videotape in the 1970s. This is just a history that is not well incorporated into the discipline. And this book is remarkable in this way that it tracks all this history down and makes it so easily and accessible to read. For the most part, we within the discipline have been going on Lucas Hildebrand's book, which is called Inherent Vice, Bootleg Histories of Videotape and Copyright. That came out in 2009. That's a great book. It's a foundational book. It doesn't delve into pornography in the same way that Peter Alalunas' book does. It talks a little bit more about other bootleg tapes, mostly the Karen Carpenter Superstar tape that was created by Todd Haynes and how that became a viral sensation. It's a foundational book, but Peter's book is kind of the expanded pornographic sequel to Lucas Hildebrand's book. And just like Hildebrand's book, it is a landmark in video history, and for Peter's book specifically, a landmark now in porn studies history. It's really, really remarkable, and I'm so happy that he agreed to be part of my first interview experiment, and he does an amazing job. He has a great voice for podcasts. I think you'll love hearing him. Just for a note of clarification, we met in Chicago doing this interview during the SCMS conference, which is short for the Society for Cinema and Media Studies Conference, which is the yearly conference which takes place every spring in a different city, and it's basically the largest film and media conference in North America. America. So I got a chance to meet and interview a few people while I was there in Chicago. Kind of a Chicago series that'll be happening throughout this early part of the podcast where you'll hear me mentioning Chicago, and it's because I was at that conference. So I just wanted to explain that, you know, what the abbreviation SEMS means before we delve into it, into the interview. There's also a point of the interview where he mentions the porn screening rooms that he found in Times Square, and that there's a map to the screening rooms, and he found that. I'm going to be including the addresses of some of those locations in the show notes, so you can see the addresses of the locations of the theaters, so you can kind of track them and follow along, for those of you who know the Times Square area. And even for those of you who don't, you can kind of get an idea of the pornographic map of Times Square at that time. So I really hope you enjoy this interview as much as I had in making it and in doing it. This is a really foundational book and text and scholar, and I really hope that comes across in the interview. And just let Peter's genius guide you through this process. I think he does a good job of it, and I think you're really going to enjoy this one. So here's my interview with Peter Alalunas. Hi, so we're here with Peter Alalunas. I just learned how to pronounce his name. We're here in some high up place in Chicago, and we're talking about his new book, Smutty Little Movies, The Creation and Regulation of Adult Video, published by University of California Press and released in 2016. Thank you for being with us.
My pleasure.
It's kind of ironic that we're actually here, because 4 years ago is when I actually first encountered you. In the same city, at the same conference, you presented a paper there, and you detailed a rather extensive use of video pornography already in use in hotels in both Los Angeles and Japan in the early 70s.
Okay, right, yes.
This was the year before Seattle. Yeah, the hotel.
Yeah.
I remember going to that panel with my co-panelist, Sharif Malabaukis. Do you know him? He's in the UK. He's a prominent UK pornographic scholar. And after your talk, and I'm not kidding whatsoever, me and Sharif, you know, walked up to each other, and both of us had our jaw on the floor, because we were both completely shocked by what you were telling us, because it seemed so opposed to the narrative in which we understand porn study. I had never heard that there was porn being shown in the 1970s in hotel rooms. Sharif didn't know it either, and he's far more, you know, knowledgeable than I am. Been following the narrative that the 80s, when people started having the VHS tapes in their house, that's when, you know, people started to access video technology. And yet, you know, this not yet fully detailed history is fleshed out, you know, in your presentation and in your book, which, you know, there's been many times where I've turned the page and yet again my jaw's on the floor, trying to understand how a lot of this history escaped us. And then, of course, unsurprisingly, you win the dissertation prize at the next SCMS, honorable mention, but who knows? I think it probably should have won first place. And then, of course, most of it morphed into this book, right?
Yeah. And if I recall, you also got an award that year.
I got an award that year, yes.
An essay award.
Student Writing Award, right. Third place. Yeah. So we're linked at least for that Seattle conference.
Yeah, and I also remember meeting you 4 years ago, because we had a nice conversation, I remember, and that's when I started thinking we had to work together. And so I'm really glad that this year we're finally on a panel together, which I've been hoping for probably since then.
And now we're doing a podcast together.
Yes.
My goodness.
Yes, it's great.
We'll be doing a book maybe.
Go
in a
edit
a years
book
too.
Who next knows? Year, yeah. Yeah.
Well, anyway, it's just, it's remarkable the journey that it took from that presentation to here right now. It's really incredible. What's striking is the quotes that you have at the back of the book as well. Like, even the grandmother of porn herself, Linda Williams, is quoted as saying that this is, quote, the best book on pornography she's ever written. I mean, really, that's saying quite a lot. I mean, how do you digest, how do you feel about the reception of the book so far? And why do you think it took so long for a detailed history of porn's transition from film to video? Why did it take so long for the narrative really to come to light through your book in really a concise way? Considering that you make the bold statement that the history of home video is the history of adult video, it seems like this book really is like 35 years in the making, yet it's only coming into fruition now.
Great questions. You know, the first of all, let me say that the quote by Linda on the back of the book made my jaw drop. I didn't know that quote was coming. And, you know,
who could expect such a thing?
As you know, anybody who's working in pornography studies seeks for and appreciates the approval of Linda Williams. And so to have her read the book at all meant a lot to me. To have her appreciate the book on that level, really, that's all anyone can dream about. I love your phrase, it's a book 35 years in the making, because that's really true. The story is that when I was in my first year of graduate school at the University of Michigan, my eventual advisor, Dan Herbert, who's a home video expert, needed a research assistant for his book project. And I had worked in video stores, and so I thought, that's perfect for me. And so I applied for the job and got the job. And the first thing he had me do was read everything ever written about home video scholarship, which didn't take very long, maybe like a few weeks.
Yeah, I mean, the main book that a lot of us know is the Lucas Hildebrand book.
Yeah, pretty small field at the time, especially. That was almost, what, 8 years ago, 9 years ago. At the end of all this reading, I went back to him and said, where's all the stuff about pornography? And he said, well, why would anybody care about that? And I was like, well, I worked in video stores in the 90s. I remember how important that was. Now, at the time, I did not identify as a pornography studies scholar at all. During my MA training at Texas, I was really interested in gender studies and masculinity. And I had written an MA thesis on Vince Vaughn and the movies of sort of the frat pack.
He's very masculine, yeah.
Yeah, and I loved this idea of like thinking about new modes of masculinity that are actually not new modes at all. They're the same old thing. But I did take one class with Janet Steiger there on pornography studies, and it stayed with me. And that's when I thought it would be a very good and productive dissertation to write about the history of adult video. And that's when I became interested in pornography studies.
Now, when you got into Michigan, what were your plans? What did you think you wanted to write a dissertation
on? I thought the idea that I had going in was to write a dissertation on masculinity in post-apocalyptic science fiction.
Oh, goodness. Okay.
Yeah. And so I went out to dinner with my advisor one night, and I was so excited to pitch him this idea. And Charlton Heston and Planet of the Apes and all this stuff. And he very, very nicely just said, "That's what else do you got?" And then years later, he was like, well, that was a terrible idea. So I'm glad I talked you out of that. And he was right. It really was not a very good dissertation idea.
And the porn studies class you took, what was it?
Well, it was an overview of representations of sex on screen. And there was a good component, maybe half the class was pornography. And I'll never forget the first time in a class screening actually watching pornography with a group. And everybody in the room kind of, you know that moment when everybody gets nervous. Mm-hmm. And I was so fascinated by that. I was like, this is kind of what I want to do. I want to figure out why people are getting freaked out right now. What is so weird about this, right? Mm-hmm. And it just stays.
Especially since we know that most of them are watching it in some capacity in their own lives. But exactly. When you put it in a group dynamic, that's when it starts getting a little
right?
weird.
Yes. Yes.
Now, but let's be fair. When you began, no one really is eager about saying, oh, I'm just going to start with the 35-year history. How do you even begin a project like this?
So I had this idea. I'm gonna write the history of adult video, and then I really quickly realized how naive that was. And graduate students love to say, "I'm gonna do the fill in the blank."
Oh, yeah,
right?
Sure, sure.
And then I quickly realized that was kind of naive and overly ambitious. But I decided to kind of chip away at it. And pretty early on, I built up a relationship with Chuck Kleinens, mm-hmm. and he was really, really helpful to me.
He's based here in Chicago, right?
Well, he lives in Oregon, but he had worked here at Northwestern.
And you're an Oregon guy.
Yeah, right. So he was really helpful, and then I slowly just kind of started branching out and meeting other people, talking to other people, and doing the reading, doing the learning, and committing myself to the topic.
What was it about that experience in the video store that touched you so much? Because usually when you have jobs and then you leave them and you forget them. What was it so particular about that job that you loved?
You know, that's a good question, because I think this actually all ties together. And it's the idea of regulation and how different kinds of regulation affect people's sexualities. I vividly remember at Silver Star Video in Eugene, Oregon, where I worked in the late 90s, we'd have to call people about late rentals. And I vividly recall calling an answering machine once and having to say, our copy of but Bongo Babes is overdue. And about an hour later, a woman comes storming into the store and says, my husband definitely did not rent this tape.
Oh, wow.
And I had to be like, well, somebody on your account rented this tape. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And those moments really are fascinating to me. Absolutely. Because of the way people are kind of afraid of sex. And that's a huge topic, right? Like, sure, we could talk for days about what that means. But yeah, the video store with its two sections, there's the porn section that's private and then everything else is out in the open. All those things fascinate me endlessly.
The social dynamics of the actual store.
Totally.
I remember, you know, going to stores as well in the early days. I mean, there would be a section. There was this wonderful video store, Manhattan World, a video in right on Greenwich Avenue that had a huge porn section. You'd see people somehow leaving with like 10 tapes. I'm like, I don't know how you're going to have the time. You can only rent them for 3 days yet.
Yes.
They're living much more exciting lives than me, I'm sure. I would like to start the podcast off with guests telling us about, you know, their first encounter with pornography, but you actually beat me to the punch when you recall an awkwardly charming story you have in the backseat of your family's car while your father goes to a local convenience store. Would you mind kind of rehashing that story and maybe explaining why it's so crucial to the narrative of this book?
Yeah. So this is in about 1986, which is actually an important detail.
Well, for my father as well. That's the last time the Mets won the World Series.
It was a big year, 1986.
Huge year. Yeah. Huge year.
So we were, I grew up in Moscow, Idaho, and we were driving after church one day. My parents are evangelical Christians, were and are. And so we were driving home from church and we pulled into the parking lot of what I think was probably a 7-Eleven. Mm. And my dad said, Peter, let's go inside for a minute and get some ice cream. And my mom and sister stayed behind in the car. And we got into the store and we bought the ice cream bars. And then my dad asked to see the manager. And I was so confused. Like, what is happening right now? What was happening is my dad wanted to complain to the store manager about Playboy magazine. And he did so really politely. And my father's a very soft-spoken guy. And he did it really politely and nicely. And then we went back out to the car and went home. And I just remember thinking, what is happening right now?
And you said you were 9 years old?
Well, I was about, in 86, I would have been 12.
12, okay. So you have some sort of idea what pornography is. You
know? Oh, yeah. And I wanted to get home and debrief with my sister, who was a little older and a little more streetwise, about what was happening. By that point, by 1986, we had already taken a family vacation to New York City, and my mother had shielded my eyes in Times Square. Mm-hmm. I had seen sex workers on the street, and my mother had been terrified. But this incident really has stayed with me over the years. The complaint, the idea that a private citizen could complain about pornography and somehow have the right to do that really has stayed with me over the years. Yeah,
because this is one of the main themes going throughout the book, restrictions and
everything. Yeah, right.
And what about one of your first encounters with actually seeing pornography?
Oh, sure. Yeah. So I've heard it described different ways, but things like woods porn or forest porn.
Kind of like a Barbara Hammer frolicking in the woods.
Well, no. Where you find like someone's pornography stash in the woods. Okay. Right. So I have some memories of finding people's adult magazines kind of under logs or something in the woods. I definitely remember magazines being passed around in the dugout, the baseball field.
Oh, wow. What a team.
Another story I tell in the book is about what I think is the first time I ever saw an adult movie, which was at a friend's house at a sleepover.
It always is.
While his parents were, I think, out of town maybe or something. But his dad was a beer distributor, and he always had those posters in the 80s of like bikini girls for beer companies. Mm-hmm. So their whole garage was decorated in these bikini posters. And so sure enough, I went over for a sleepover, and my friend said, well, you know, my dad has a stash of adult tapes, which did not surprise me at all with the posters. So yeah, we watched an adult video. And in the book, I say I can't remember what it was, mm-hmm. but I have since remembered what it was. Mm-hmm. Maybe if you're...
It's always in the back recesses.
Yeah, yeah. If your listeners want to know, it was actually Taboo, the Kay Parker movie.
Oh, okay.
It has since come back to me.
Easy title to remember.
Yeah.
Unsurprisingly, your narrative starts in New York City. and the pornographic circulation around Times Square, you don't start in the 1970s. You actually go all the way back to the 1940s, not just to the self-cranking mutoscopes that were essentially large flipbooks that were offering pornography in the area since like the 1800s, but to a device that I had never heard of before called the Panoram, which was sold by a gentleman called George Ponzer exclusively to arcades so they could offer their patrons individual viewing conditions to watch pornography. In the book, you offer a great poster of a 1943 cartoon advertisement in the book that shows how customers actually use the machine. It also reveals that a Ponzer was selling it for only $495. You know, their cell phone, most cell phones aren't even $495 today. Best way I can describe it is that it's a taller version of like Edison's kinetoscope. You don't have to hunch over to watch it. It's at eye level. And as the gentleman looks into the individual peephole, we see that he's getting quite excited with like little markers around his head. I'm not a very technical person, so could you please detail the exact technology that went into the Panoram and what was going on inside this box and what were viewers witnessing inside this peephole?
Yeah, so the Panoram, it fascinates me too. And I first kind of discovered this technology in the work of Amy Herzog, who is kind of an expert in this. The best way I can describe it is a very tall television set. Now, initially, it was, you know, film strips inside of it. And you'd put a quarter in or a nickel and it would play back the material. But it was sort of like what you might perceive as a television screen size box. And it would be in bars as an alternative to the jukebox. Mm. And so what was typically produced for this machine was musical acts. A little 5-minute kind of music video.
Now, is this a little film projected onto a screen inside the box?
Yeah.
Okay, 16 millimeter, 8 millimeter. Okay.
Yeah, right. So
interesting.
Could
you start and stop it, or did it just go all night?
I think it would just on a loop.
On a loop.
So you'd put your nickel in or your quarter, and then it would play for however long, and then stop, and then you'd put another and keep going. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, before this technology was even officially released to the market, there was adult material being produced for it locally. I have this great example I found in Los Angeles of a bar kind of being used as a test run, market research type situation.
For the Panoram.
Yeah. And the press was invited to come take a look at it. And a newspaper reporter described seeing, quote unquote, adult material that had clearly been produced locally in Los Angeles for playback on this machine. Mm. Now, the company that manufactured them obviously did not want this, but that's the nature of technology, right? People are going to put sex on it.
Yeah.
So eventually what happened is these new technologies were added to it to make the screen more private. Because the idea was the entire bar could see the screen like a visual jukebox. So this peephole device made it so only one person would see, but still everybody else could hear, which would have been really, really interesting.
That
maybe
interesting.
If they could have heard the burlesque music or something. We don't have a lot of records for the adult material that was being played at first on these machines, but I imagine it was probably kind of striptease acts filmed by bar owners. Eric Schaefer's work has helped me to understand that little economy, especially in LA. Later, we have lots of records of people being arrested for showing a whole variety of stuff, which is very typical from the era. Striptease acts, posing, women undressing and dressing and combing their hair and doing all these unusual kind of activities. And then a little bit later on, there was actual sex being shown on these devices.
Yeah. Really remarkable.
Yeah.
Remarkable. And the LA showing, that was also in the 40s as well?
Yeah.
The early 40s.
Yeah. I want to say 46, but mm-hmm. you could check.
It always takes a while for East Coast stuff to make it to the West Coast. Yeah, you go on to claim that the setup of this device led to the advent of more private viewing practices that we know today as private booths. And so could you maybe walk us through what is like the timeline between the Panoram and the lead up to the private booth, and what were some of the technological advancements that happened during that time?
Yeah, so these Panoram machines were fairly popular for their initial purpose, which is to say these kind of visual jukeboxes. Eventually, though, they, for a variety of reasons, kind of fell out of popularity, and they started being used maybe a little bit more exclusively for adult material, if not pornographic material. And then they kind of just started to fade out entirely. Now, later, a guy comes into the scene named Martin Hodes in New York. And he was kind of a small-time jack-of-all-trades, pinball, other novelties. You know, he kind of just did a little bit of everything in terms of supplying bars with entertainments. And he saw one of these converted Panoram machines at a roadside kind of tavern in New Jersey while he was driving home. And the reports I've read say that what he saw was an adult film. And he kind of had this flash of an idea that he could supply all of Manhattan with these machines. And so that's what he did. He I think either a week or 2 weeks later, he went back to the same tavern in New Jersey and he bought up all of their Panorams. He took them all to Manhattan and tried to lease them to adult bookstores. Nobody would take them because of these very strict licensing laws in New York about what you were allowed to show on screen. No one was willing to take the risk.
There's no shortage of laws in New York.
Right. And so these laws said that Panorams were considered kind of theatrical exhibition, which is really weird today. But at the time, that was the rule. Finally, he found one adult bookstore in Times Square that would take these machines on a trial basis. And they were willing to kind of fight back against this regulation. And they were a massive overnight smashing success. And then eventually he put them in more and more bookstores all around Times Square.
Now, this is not with the more private peep shows.
That's
this
right.
is more of
this
an is, open
well, this
kind
would
of private
be,
booth.
This would be with the kind of like shielding privacy device.
Okay.
So a Panoram with a peephole, sort of. He even went to the manufacturer in Kentucky and ordered more of them.
Mm-hmm.
He ordered more Panoram machines to put in Times Square. So this would be in the 60s.
Also, kind of like a resurgence.
Yeah. He kind of had single-handedly had this idea to test these out. Now, I've read that in Times Square, there actually were a handful of these machines already in use. But they were a little more of a novelty item for tourists. And the exact content on the machines has kind of eluded me. It might just be provocative and risque and not necessarily fully nude or pornographic. What Martin Hodes did is actually put that kind of content on these machines.
Now, was this new footage or was he recycling older footage?
That is an excellent question. At first, it was recycled footage, but then later he went into production on his own.
Mm. And what was this guy's background?
He was just a small-time
just
pinball.
So he had no filmmaking experience.
I really don't think so, yeah.
Interesting.
He later made his own films with these great titles like Elevator Party. I mean, I want to see a movie called Elevator Party. That sounds great. So the next step in this technological timeline is that other people, including the legendary Reuben Sturman in Ohio, decided to take the peep show machine and enclose it fully.
Mm.
And that's where we get the idea of kind of the peep booth.
It's interesting. The whole history that you're talking about is almost like the history of pornography is the history of amateur film.
Oh, definitely.
I mean, it's just like it's all a bunch of amateurs trying to figure it out all at the same time. Not only with the making of them, but also with the technology behind it. It's really remarkable.
Yeah, that's a very good way to put it. People just trying to figure it out.
Yep.
Yeah.
So you go on to describe a fascinating type of skid row of innovative theaters in Times Square that feature porn screening rooms and booths utilizing video intelligence technology in 1971, starting off with the first theater that opened, I believe it's the first one, called Channel 69, which was the first video theater open in New York. And alongside it were three gay video theaters, Channel X, Adonis, Cinema Club, and Tomcat, all featuring video content. Once again, 1971. Channel 69 gave you access to their bank of televisions for $2. And what I found most remarkable about their story is that they actually produced their own content. Though about them producing their own content, there is a very funny quote that talks about the type of footage that's actually shown on these things. From Screw Magazine's Peter Brennan, who describes these productions as such, quote, "Not only can't you see the fine details of anatomy, but the color rendition is terrible. Flesh comes off in various shades of orange and green, and the screen is so small you can't just sit back and get engulfed in the sexual activity. You have to keep straining to see. Moreover, no attempt is being made to use the creative possibilities of videotape. The program consists mostly of unedited clinical close-ups of cocks pumping away in cunts and mouths. Ouch, that's a scathing review.
Yeah, that description has always jumped out at me as proving the idea that people's desire for sex media is always so great that it overcomes technological distraction, right? Yeah.
Well, I mean, all of us can, I don't know, maybe not all of us, but, you know, those squiggly lines that's showing you can see one breast or one thing. We've all been there younger.
Yes, yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, I would love to have more detail about this Skid Row and then really but what kind of experience did you get when you walked into Channel 69?
Yeah, so let me say that the story of how I found these theaters is...
What street was this on?
Oh, gosh, we'd have to look. Okay. We'd have to look back at the ads, which we can do.
I like to walk down Times Square sometimes and recreate these fantasies.
Yeah, yeah. I'll send you the map. I have a map of all their locations.
That'd be fabulous.
They were all on the outer edges of Times Square. I'll send you the map. I'm going to be there next week, actually, in New York. And I plan on walking those streets myself.
I would love to walk with you. Maybe you'll have like an audio walk.
Oh, you're there.
Walk. I live there.
Yeah. Let's do it. That'd be fantastic. Okay, yeah. I'm leaving here and going to New York.
So am I.
sorry, listeners. You don't get to be part of that.
No, but we will put the map in the show notes.
Oh, I love that. That's great.
Yeah, so they can definitely see the map.
Yes, let's do that. Okay, so when I was just starting this research, I found Joseph Slade's article about theaters in Times Square. I think it's actually called Theaters in Times Square from 1971. And it's a great ethnography, personal history of his own experiences there in the adult movie theaters, plus a little bit of commentary about pornography at the time. It was a really important article published in Transaction magazine.
So not an academic.
No, and a little bit looser tone to it. I'd call it an ethnography. And so when I read this article, I was sitting in the basement of the library at the University of Michigan doing lots and lots of reading that day. And about six pages into the article, he says that the quality in the theaters is better than the quality in the locations showing homemade adult videotapes. Now, Brandon, I jumped out of my chair in the basement of the library because there's a reference to homemade videotapes in 1971. The first Betamax is sold in December of 1975. I could not understand what he was talking about. And unfortunately, he doesn't have a lot of detail. He just says that there's a handful of spaces in New York showing homemade adult videotapes. Well, this turned into a years-long obsession for me. It became the holy grail of my research to figure out what the hell he was talking about. Now, Professor Slade is not only still alive, he's still working. I immediately reached out to him in Indiana. Unfortunately, his memory this many years later is not great.
So his whole work wasn't focused on pornography.
Well, it was, but he had no notes from that day. Oh, okay. He just couldn't remember anything about it. And so I spent years trying to unpack this. Now, on the eve of the publication of my book, literally days before I had to have the final page proofs finished, Eric Schaefer, the legendary, the great Eric Schaefer, close friend of mine, as he is to all of us in pornography studies, emails me out of the blue. I've never told anyone this story before, with a scan from Screw Magazine and a very simple email that just says, you might find this of use. And what that article in Screw Magazine was the answer to the question I had been searching years for, which is to say the names and addresses and information and details about those video theaters in New York in 1971. And that unlocked for me the mystery of where to go look for all the rest of the information. And that was it. That was all I needed. Once I had that, I furiously spent the next few days doing as much research as I could to get that book finished. So I did find all this stuff, this information about these spaces and these theaters. And it turns out they were only in operation for a few months. And Slade,
the theaters that I mentioned.
Yeah, and Slade happened to go to them while they were open for those few months and write about them.
Wow.
So when you say a history 35 years in the making, there really is a line here from Slade's visit in 1971 to the publication of his article in Transaction magazine, to me writing this book, and all of us remembering those spaces now as the pioneering, groundbreaking things they were, right?
It's incredible.
Channel 69 was on the second floor of a building that's still there today. It's a French restaurant now. Tiny little room, smaller than this hotel room we're doing this interview in. And at one end of the room was a television set sitting on the floor, and then the rest of the room was wooden chairs, and you paid an entry fee. And
went one television.
One television, okay. And you sat at the end of the room, and you watched these films on this one television set. Other spaces, like the Adonis, had multiple televisions and kind of a bar atmosphere, but they did not have a liquor license. So you'd get kind of like an orange juice at the bar and maybe spike it yourself, and then watch these films being played in this kind of bar environment. And they were all out of business within 2 months. They were all gone within 2 months.
They weren't making money, or the quality was bad? I guess we don't know.
I think it was probably related to the quality. I think people...
But there was no like crackdown or the police, you know.
Not that I've seen, yeah. I think it was a combination of poor quality, poor viewing environments. And to be totally frank about it, I think people were having more success in the theaters getting the sexual experiences they wanted. You know,
that's
go,
true. Yeah, it's more interactive.
Right. Yeah. So I think these very small video spaces did not have enough room for people to kind of, you know, get it on.
Even the way you're describing it, it sounds very clinical, like a metal television with light. And like, it doesn't have the warmth of a 35 millimeter of dark. It seems very clinical.
Yeah, and bigger spaces, right? When you read Samuel Delaney's descriptions, it's like, who wouldn't want to go to these big, beautiful, warm rooms lots and lots of people? So, yeah, I agree with you.
Also, this story strikes me that there needs to be a book about the history of Screw Magazine. Because you bring it up all the time, and he's a very political character. Yeah. Al Goldstein, he was on the Howard Stern show a lot, too. And it seems like that book needs to happen as well.
Yes.
So before we shift to what was happening on the West Coast, you kind of initiate a rhetoric around affect when you write about how the history that you're developing is culled from, quote, a desperate and fragmented sources, unquote, and that, quote, the trace historiographer must often examine the smoke rather than the fire to determine how the fire is started, what burned and why, unquote. Could you go into a little bit more detail about this somewhat effective approach to developing history, and what were some of your own struggles in making this book happen? How did your professors guide you through a workable methodology? This haunting word, what is your methodology?
Yeah.
Considering how many historical sources you had to weave together in order to make this happen.
Yeah, so as this process went on through graduate school, and I got deeper and deeper into the research, it became clear to me that it would be an overwhelming amount of material, and I would never be able to look at all of it. And that was partly because I would never be able to find all of it. One thing I have definitely learned in the decade I have spent doing pornography studies is that it is very difficult to locate the sources that we need. They exist, but they are very hard to find. There's not an infrastructure in place like the interlibrary loan or the traditional archive or the traditional network of scholars that can help us find and then use this material. That's number one. Number two is that if you do find this material, it was subject to all kinds of regulations of its own. So it's very incomplete at best. It's spotty. It's sketchy. It's sometimes not professionally produced. It wasn't in conventional journals or publications. You have to rely on oral histories. A lot of it is totally unreliable. So about midway through the project, I realized that what I was doing was closer to the work of a homicide detective than a PhD candidate. I was trying to figure out who murdered this person, but it wasn't a person, it was the past. And that's when I kind of started thinking about historiography as a methodology. I trained with Richard Abel at Michigan, who is a brilliant French film historian, and he taught me all the methods to do film history, but very few of them worked for pornography history. So I started thinking kind of about the theory of what I was up to. And that's when I hit on this idea of traces, pieces, fragments, and how you have to put those fragments into a narrative. And then the work of Lynn Spiegel and Eric Schaefer and a few others kind of plugged in some of those pieces for me. And I think that captures the feeling we have. I know you must have this feeling too of ephemera and kind of the ghostly feeling that you're onto something, but you don't know quite what it is. That sort of stuff.
Yeah, I'm just trying to... All my work is just digging into what this idea of ephemera or affect even means. And I just dig deeper into that. And then it takes far more sophisticated people like yourself to do the historical work, because I deal in moments and, you know, instances and I can't even imagine doing a historical thing like you did. It's truly remarkable. So shifting to the West Coast, you rely on an amazing story out of, you relay an amazing story out of Osaka, Japan in 1971, where as a result of their steel rooftop railing of this love hotel, they begin accidentally transmitting their own closed circuit pornographic feed into nearby homes, quote, prompting the police to issue a polite warning to innkeepers to make sure that such accidents were not repeated in the future, unquote. Perhaps even more astounding than that is that within these same 500 love hotels, they provided cameras and video recorders for in-room use. How on earth did this camera recording system work, and were you able to find any of these videos within the course of your research? I mean, we know what a video camera in 1980 feels like. It's huge. How does a video camera in 1970 look like?
Oh, you know what? That's the new holy grail. To actually find footage from those love hotels. Oh, that would be amazing. No, the answer is no. I've actually done only a very small amount of research into these Japanese hotels. That's a sprawling story that is in need of deep excavation. There is one book written on this that I'm aware of, but it's a semi-academic book, semi-not. Very necessary work there. I should say that I have a thick file. This is kind of a hobby of mine. I collect, and I invite your listeners to send me examples. I collect instances of accidental pornography. So this story in Japan is a perfect representation of that, where a child is accidentally exposed to pornography through a technology not intended for it. And the great illustration of this is always cable TV mishaps, someone hijacks a cable signal and plays porn for a few seconds. I love when this happens.
It's kind of like in Fight Club where they put the one frame of porn in.
Yes, it's the rupture of the normal, and I absolutely adore when that happens. So that is a beautiful illustration of that, the thing touching the metal railing and then pornography is everywhere, right? Yeah, the love hotels and their in-room cameras are an incredible story that needs to be told. I imagine those cameras were extremely bulky, probably bolted to the ground or something, right?
And it must have been extremely expensive to even get into a room that you can do something like that.
Yeah, and I do know that in Japan at that time, very large families all shared a home together. So young people, often married, had to escape the family home for a few minutes of privacy, and these hotels provided that. So there was a cultural tradition there of this.
One thing that you do go into very much detail that kind of does the same thing is, shifting back to America, is the Auto Lodge Motel.
Oh, yeah.
That opened in 1970 and is located in Los Angeles. Could you tell us the experience of this Auto Lodge?
Yeah, I love the Auto Lodge. To me, it's an American treasure. It should be in the Smithsonian.
Does it still exist?
No, it's what's there now on that site is the Staples Center.
Oh my
God. The Staples Center complex takes up that whole area of LA. But to me, they should have saved the facade of this building and put it in the Smithsonian. The Auto Lodge Motel was a very typical downtown LA motel for many years. And then it was sold to a group of investors, including a lawyer named Don Leon. And Don Leon was kind of a small-time Hollywood fringe producer in the adult sector, maybe softcore. And he had some clients that were definitely involved in the adult film industry outskirts. And he accepted the motel as payment for a legal fee, if I understand the story correctly. And he convinced the other investors in his partnership to convert the motel into an adult motel after he saw a story in Time magazine about what was happening in Japan. And so the Auto Lodge became the first place in the United States to convert to this new business method. And by business method, I just mean that they installed a closed circuit system in all the rooms. And then for a fee, you could access adult films on the TV in the room. This was the first time in the United States this had happened. So to me, that entire system should be in the Smithsonian, right?
Absolutely.
Like private adult films
people
for the
made
first
billions,
time.
Billions
right?
Of that.
I mean, right now in this hotel in Chicago, left and right, thousands of dollars are being spent on this technology and no one wants to talk about it. This is the origin of that technology. So the Auto Lodge converted, and then a few months, we'd have to check the dates, but I want to say a few months later, they changed the name to The Experience. They rebranded it as this kind of like adult playground, and they had this giant key sign. And it was actually there for decades, and it was quite a well-known institution in LA, the Experience Motel.
Now, yeah. This was only closed circuit accessing pornography, not creating pornography in the rooms, no video.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah.
And where did he? What tapes did he use? Did he use tape? Did he convert film into video? What was the process?
Yeah, I spent quite a long time trying to figure that out. What was he actually showing in these rooms? So it was a combination of, I think, maybe three things. First and most importantly, it was pirated material from adult theaters. So in LA at the same time, they're showing things like, you know, Mona and then later Deep Throat and Boys in the Sand. And those were being pirated at night and then converted to video. And then
maybe the projector would take the footage and then take it to the pirator for money.
That's exactly it. Okay, yeah, they would sneak it right out the back door at night.
Now, that's an expensive process.
Oh,
who's
absolutely
paying for that?
Yeah. So
who's paying to convert this?
Well, probably Don Leon. Mm-hmm. He denied this in interviews. He would say, I have no idea where our material comes from. But we know that's not true. We know because of all kinds of anecdotal reports that adult motels were playing the exact same titles that were showing in theaters right down the street. So a lot of those films are semi-lost to history now because they're the precursors to the more well-known material. But they were definitely being bootlegged out the back door and sent right over to the adult motels. The second kind of content was stag films that had been repurposed. So very well-worn footage, very old, decades old probably. And then the third type was content produced directly for the motels.
By just amateurs.
By amateurs or sometimes by the same people who owned the motels. I'm looking into a case right now in Portland, Oregon, near where I live, where there was a warehouse by the river in the downtown that was rented out at night and on weekends to shoot all male material to be shown in motels in Portland, say exclusively in motels. Mm. The demand was so high for new material, right?
Wow.
So I'm just starting to kind of research that. The material shot for motels, I should say. Yeah.
It's incredible.
Yeah.
It's really incredible.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe it's because I've never been to LA, so I have this, you know, kind of mysterious aspect of it, but it does seem to be a New York LA divide in your book. Do you have a feel for the type of way people consume and absorb pornography in New York versus the way it's consumed and made in LA?
Yeah, isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
One specific difference I can point to right on this topic is that at the same moment you have this history of adult films being played on closed circuit systems in LA, you have the rise of what's called hotel video in New York City, where big companies were experimenting with closed circuit systems in very well-known cosmopolitan hotels like the Commodore in New York City, adamantly without pornography. They were very public about this. There will be no adult films played in hotels in New York City. Hotels now. This is a class distinction, right? Motels and hotels. So in New York City, you could go to a hotel and watch Patton in your room, but not pornography. And in LA, you could go to your room and watch pornography. But in New York, you could go down the street to the Adonis.
Mm, mm.
You know, you could go to these great palaces and see all the porn you could ever want.
Mm.
So yeah, this is a very good distinction about the two cities, because in LA, that move to privacy happened a little bit sooner than it did in New York.
Well, yeah, LA has the car culture, right? Everything is in your car, you're private. In New York, everything's completely out in the open.
Right.
You're on the sidewalk, there's no alleyways.
Yeah, you take the train up to Times Square and go to the theater. In LA, you take your car to the motel.
Makes you just want to visit LA more. And then, of course, one of the biggest names you go into detail with is George Atkinson. You describe as the founder of the Home Theater Systems, which was an all-encompassing service that would rent you, for your own private home use, a projector, a screen, and movies themselves, a type of newer version of the traveling stag shows that would travel between various all-male screenings. Can you tell us more about how we put this business together? I mean, that seems like a big capital investment.
Yeah, this, you know, of all the stories I tell in the book, this is the one that I'm personally the most invested in and pleased with. George Atkinson is kind of in the Smithsonian in the sense that home video historians and just media historians in general not only acknowledge who he is, they know who he is, and they kind of pay tribute to him as the person who invented home video rental. He is a well-known figure in history. When I was doing this research, though, I just had a feeling. I kind of had this intuition that there was more to him than was being let on. So early on in the research, I started digging around into his past. And what I learned is that he was one of the early suppliers of what's known as public domain footage. There was this thriving market in the 60s and 70s of public domain films being rented out for all kinds of reasons. Educational, church groups, civic centers, but then also places like bars, pizza parlors. Shakey's Pizza was really well known at the time for showing Abbott and Costello and Charlie Chaplin films that were in the public domain.
On a television screen?
They would project them like 16 millimeter across the restaurant. And those all had to be supplied by people. And so I learned all about this kind of network of public domain suppliers. The public domain suppliers were, as it turns out, totally tied in with the bootleggers. And what I quickly learned is that the bootleggers were responsible for putting all the adult films into the adult motels. Mm. And so this constellation began to emerge where the public domain films, the bars in LA, the pizza parlors, and the adult motels were all being supplied by the same people. And that's the moment I realized that George Atkinson had to have been involved with pornography. There is no way he was not supplying Shakey's Pizza with Chaplin and not working for the adult motels. He had to have been. So this was Holy Grail number two. I was determined to find evidence of this. And so one summer in grad school, I went to the library and I pulled the LA Times on microfilm and I just started going page by page.
Fun.
Yeah, for weeks, just page by page by page, just looking for anything. And what I finally found was that his address that was used for the first video rental business in America is the same address that was on a business that rented 16 millimeter projectors to people for private parties to show adult films.
Oh my goodness.
And I put all that story together. And so sure enough, George Atkinson was definitely renting pornography to people in LA. There's just no question. He's deceased, obviously, now today, so I was not able to kind of go interview him about this. James Lardner, who wrote the great book called Fast Forward about the history of home video, has a huge amount of material on George Atkinson and no reference whatsoever to pornography. Even though if you go back now and read that book and you read my book, it's really obvious what Atkinson was doing. Mm-hmm. But he wouldn't talk about it.
You've talked to a lot of video historians. What do you think was the stigma about not talking about pornography when it seems like one of the biggest drivers of people buying a videotape? There was one thing where you said that in 1978, 50% of the videotapes sold in America were pornographic.
Yeah.
So how do you not include this history? I mean, it's one of the many pitfalls of academia. We only talk about what we want to talk about.
Yeah. You know, I think that there's a stigma with any emerging area of scholarship. And so for a long time, home video scholarship was stigmatized as being not serious. It was already a bad object. And pornography is always the worst object. So pick any academic subject, and then the pornographic aspect of it, which there will inevitably there will be, is always the least respected of the least respected, right? So those early pioneers of home video scholarship were already fighting kind of an uphill battle. And pornography just got kind of pushed to the back of the line. And I kind of felt like what I was doing was just joining the line. Mm-hmm. I consider myself one of those scholars. And so I'm just in that group, and here's the stuff on pornography. Caitlin Benson Allitt, who is the new editor of Cinema Journal, She has a brilliant book on home video called Shattered Screens. And she writes in that book about how home video is not necessarily taken very seriously. And that really helped me see why this was in particular being ignored. But it really shouldn't be anymore. There's really no reason now for future home video scholars to not take this up.
Well, academia, you know, they only feel good about something when it's in the distance. And, right. You know, then, you know, just studying YouTube now is considered, like, sometimes stupid, but, you know.
Yeah.
I'm writing an essay on Chris Crocker, so, you know, someone has to do it.
Yes.
I mean, we have to finish. We're literally, just for those listening, only scratching the surface of this book. There's another huge chapter about the adult video news and how that emerged. Ginger Lynn and Candida Royale. Yeah. The Mies Commission. Just get the book. It's really fantastic. But we'll end with one question. One of my favorite quotes from Walter Kendrick, the very famous pornographic historian. Pornography is best defined, quote, not as being a thing, but a concept, a thought structure, unquote. I love the quote because it situates pornography for what it truly is, simply a framework for how we as a society think about sexuality and how those who want to distract us establish regulations around sexuality.
Yeah.
Why are we, you know, let's not worry about feeding the poor. We have to ban pornography. And for you, you use it as the main framing of your book, detailing how in the case of the easier to access technology, pornography felt as if it had to fight for its place of respectability within American culture. You know, the respectability of the two porn stars you profile and how AVN kind of frames pornography as a fight for respectability. You know, this is the main thrust of your book, which is really remarkable. How do you kind of see this playing out today? And do you feel like internet pornography went through slash is going through the same fight? And how do we kind of march forward as a society and get past this and just, you know, take it for what it is with all that you've learned in this time?
Yeah, you know, Walter Kendrick has been a huge inspiration to me. I try to read his book at least once a year.
Wow.
And the end of his book has a really brilliant kind of analysis of what was then contemporary before he died. And his conclusion is that the fights will probably always be happening. They'll just change. And I see now that he was right. What we have in America right now is this new attempt to reframe the discussion as harm. Pornography will harm the public. So legislators now in various states are introducing these bills where we just declare pornography to be a public harm. Have you seen these?
It just happened in Canada a few weeks ago. One of the MPs wants to say that pornography is an evil.
And the bills don't do anything. They just make this declaration. But the problem with declarations is that they affect discourse. And then discourse has a real impact on people. And so this is exactly what Kendrick was talking about. Pornography is not a thing. It's not a magazine we can point to or a movie or a tape or a website. It's a thought structure about people's pleasure and how dangerous it can be, which is, to me, just totally absurd. I can't think of anything more absurd than worrying about what someone else does with their body. Michael Warner, in his brilliant book, The Trouble with Normal, he literally opens the book by saying, sooner or later, everybody succumbs to the temptation to worry about someone else's sex life. And that's what these legislators are doing, is worrying about other people's bodies. Pornography is endlessly fascinating to me because it captures kind of people's desire to flaunt normalcy. And I just love that. I love anytime hegemony is ruptured and fucked with, and I hope I can say that. And, you know, just like this bullshit idea that that hegemonies are intact all the time. They're not. And pornography is a beautiful way. Sex is a beautiful way to rupture that in general. I say more pornography, not less. More. Always more.
Listen, if one positive thing you could say about Trump, his wife has done softcore pornography. So he's never said a bad word about pornography.
Yeah.
So maybe there's light, you know, there's light at the end of this tunnel with the Donald Trump presidency.
Yeah.
Anything else you'd like to say?
Well, thank you for having me on. Thank you for reading the book and all your kind things to say about it.
This might be the one book I read every year. So that's how essential it
thank
is.
Thank you, Brandon.
So
that's
nice. Thank you so much, Peter, for joining us. It's been fantastic. And see you next time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
A I just want to thank Peter again for such a fun interview. The information for his book will be in the show notes. The information about the theaters will also be in the show notes. They'll also be on our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/academicsex. They won't allow us to use the word porn in our page description. You could also find us on Twitter, @pornocultures. Keep up with us and other fun things that are happening on the internet there. And I look forward to talking to you next time. Thanks for listening.